Today is the day to wake, work, and win. Welcome to The Standard. Hey, Dave, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate being here and flattered and honored that you would invite me to be a part of this. Thank you very much.
Chief, I've been lucky enough to sit in a few of your high-rise classes. How did that become the subject you wanted to be an expert in?
You know, as I think you know, my dad was on the job. He was on the Denver Fire Department for 42 years. He worked from 55 to 97. So I actually got to work with him for a period of time when we were together on the Denver Fire Department. But, you know, as a young kid growing up, I idolized him, still do idolize him, and was watching him. He was a firefighter in downtown Denver, and as a little kid, I'd go down to the firehouse all the time. And, you know, at that time, there weren't the number of high-rises down there then as there are now, but there were still high-rise buildings. And he and his crew would go down to Brooks Towers, which is a high-rise down on 15th Street downtown, and that was one of the taller buildings way back in the day, 44 stories. And they would climb the stairs with backpacks and do all the stuff that you and I do today. And that's the first time I saw guys doing that or heard about them doing that. But certainly watching my dad as a kid, as I'm growing up, watching him as a downtown Denver firefighter, that was kind of where I suppose the seed was planted that I really became interested in high-rise operations. Certainly didn't know anything about it, but became interested in it by watching him, and always was fascinated with it. After I got on the job, had the opportunity to go to some high-rise fires, and most significant for me was a high-rise fire that I went to on Halloween, October 31st of 1991. And the fire happened in a building called the Polo Club Condominiums. It's a high-rise building in southeast Denver. You know, I went to that fire at the time I was assigned as a firefighter on Rescue 1, and we went to the fire, and very significant fire. Was a wind-driven fire. Didn't know it at the time and certainly didn't have the information that you and I have today, but when we walked into the lobby, the chief gave us an assignment to go up to the fire floor and assist with a backup line. But when we walked into the lobby, there was a blue flame coming out of the apartment into an atrium. And it's a building that has an interior atrium from the lobby all the way up to several skylights on the roof. And as we walked into the lobby, there's this powerful blue flame coming out of what was apartment 702. We didn't know that at the time. And my mind and the experience that I had, I was thinking, is there natural gas up there? Or, you know, what's going on? What's causing this blue flame? There's a very forceful blue flame coming out of this apartment and kind of auto-exposing the upper floors within the atrium. And once again, didn't know it at the time, but it was a wind-driven fire. The windows had failed, and there was a northerly wind on the building that day, cold outside, warm inside, all those things that we now understand are kind of the factors that kind of help create a wind-driven fire. So got up there and got underway, and I remember thinking in the process of that firefight that it was probably one of the first times in my career, and I'd been on for 9 years at the time, but one of the first times in my career where I was really uneasy in terms of we're a long ways from being okay here, because we're all the way up to the seventh floor, we're down this hall, we've made a couple of turns, we're trying to make it into this apartment. It isn't like we can just take a couple steps back and bail out a window or whatever the case may be. But for me, after that fire, I realized how much I didn't really know and how much I didn't understand with regard to high-rise fires and high-rise firefighting. And as they say, you don't know what you don't know. And there was a lot of stuff I didn't know. So from there, I wrote an article about that high-rise fire, and it was published in Fire Engineering Magazine, and started to develop a relationship with the folks from Fire Engineering. And at one point, I thought, you know, one of the ways I can learn more about this subject and get better at it and so forth is to start, you know, once again, doing research, vicarious experience from other firefighters, my own experiences, try and put that together, do articles, do teaching, try to improve what my own organization was doing. And then that kind of built up to writing the book. And one of the first people I called when I was in the process of wanting to write the book is retired Chief Vincent Dunn from New York, because I figure if there's anybody that's an expert on this, he is. And I wanted to see, are you planning on writing a book, is what I asked him. And because I don't want to be like this kid from, you know, Denver that's going to try and step on the toes of a chief from New York about writing a book. And he said, no, go for it. And so I did. And from there, it's just kind of catapulted into learning more about it and having more knowledge about it and continually trying to improve my corner of the fire service and help other firefighters improve what they're doing. So that's kind of a little bit of how it started. But
so what's it like being a second generation firefighter? You know, growing up in the firehouse, did it spark that passion into the fire service?
Yeah, true. I think that yes to all of that. You know, growing up, when I was born, my dad had been on the job for 8 years, and it was everything when we were going down to the firehouse to visit my dad. It was any excuse we could get to talk my mom into taking us to the firehouse for a visit. That was like that would just totally make my day. And so visited my dad a lot. And one of the things, and it's interesting you ask that question, because one of the things I was thinking of is I always remember to this day the smell of the firehouse when I walked in. And it was kind of a combination of a lot of different things, because it was the old-fashioned firehouses, but you know, the smell of the rigs, the smell of turnout coats, the smell of them having been at a fire recently, all the stuff that we're not supposed to do now, you know, in terms of making sure that the turnouts and everything are clean. Well, back in the day, they weren't really clean. You could smell that they'd been to a fire. You could smell what they were cooking on the stove. Sometimes it would be like spaghetti on a Sunday or whatever. But I always remember that smell, and it was very unique to me. But I don't know if I was born with the passion or what, but I always wanted to be a firefighter. And certainly growing up and watching my dad, that just continued to build on that. I always told him and my mom, this is what I wanted to do. My dad used to say to me, he used to tell me, are you sure this is what you want to do? There's a lot of things out there. You want to keep your mind open to a lot of things. And I was never sure why he was saying that to me. Probably just wanted me to cover all my bases, but it was the only thing I ever wanted to do. And when I was in college, I got the opportunity to be hired by the Aurora Fire Department, your department. And I worked there for 5 years while I was trying to test to get on the Denver Fire Department. And it was a tremendous experience being a brand new firefighter and learning on the Aurora Fire Department. And then when I got on Denver, that was my ultimate dream, because my father worked there. And so I think the passion has always been there. The fact that I have a father that was and still is passionate about the fire service, because he's still very much engaged. He's 85 years old, but he has a radio and listens to the calls that we're on and so forth. And we talk about things, and I can still call on him for advice and guidance on stuff that he experienced and so forth. But yeah, it was a family affair. He was always very passionate about it. I think I got that from him. Continue to try to be passionate about it to this day. And it's, I'm very fortunate and blessed to have him and as my mentor and to kind of watch him and learn from him and develop that passion. But yeah, still very much passionate about it today.
So you've learned a lot about high-rise. The firefighter community has, you know, labeled you as one of the experts in high-rise firefighting. So with that, how important do you think basic firefighting skills are in high-rise firefighting operations?
I think that's the basics are everything, I think, with everything we do. And it's interesting because it seems like every time we see a, you know, post-incident analysis or a fire review or some sort of a critique or whatever, usually it's the basics that are the cause of problems that occurred during the operation. So I think the basics are critical. And as you ask that question, one of the things that I see occurring across the fire service, and it bothers me a lot, is, you know, what's happening with automatic alarms on these buildings. You know, any firefighter that you talk to knows that automatic alarms can become kind of a nuisance. You know, obviously it's not our favorite thing, but I always liked automatic alarms because it gives us an opportunity to go into a building. And oftentimes, at least in my city, it's a high-rise building where there's an automatic alarm. But it gets you into the building. It allows you to learn a little bit about the building. It allows you to find out if the systems in the building are working properly. And, you know, hone your basic fundamental skills.
It's another rep.
Yeah, it's absolutely another rep. And so I never thought of it as, oh, geez, we're going on another automatic alarm. I thought thought of it and still do think of it as an opportunity to get in there, practice for the real deal, and learn a little bit about that building. So across the fire service, we see fire departments that are reducing responses to automatic alarms, and certainly there's a need for that. If it's a standalone Taco Bell, you could see sending a single company to a standalone Taco Bell, a small barber shop, a small commercial building, whatever, perhaps to investigate an automatic alarm that has come in many times before and there's no follow-up 911 calls, that sort of thing. As for a high-rise, though, we still need to be sending an appropriate response and go through that whole process, the basics of, you know, good elevator discipline, proper apparatus placement, spotting properly for the pumper close to the FDC. I always tell the firefighters that I work with, go ahead and grab a handset. I know this is just an automatic alarm, but grab a handset, because let's treat this as if it was a fire, and when we prove otherwise, we'll move on with our lives. But take a handset up. They can check and see if the handset works, if the communication system in the building's working, check the PA system, check the performance of the elevator. And the basics of even on this automatic alarm that has a probability of not becoming a real fire, stopping two floors below in the elevator, getting out, using the stairs, finding out if the master's keys work in the stairs to let us in. There's so many things you can discover by following the basics and doing everything we would do at a real deal fire at an automatic alarm. I think that helps us in the long run. So absolutely, it's all about the basics of a good standpipe stretch, the basics of hooking up an attack line on the floor below, the basics of elevator discipline, the basics of being in shape so that you can climb the stairs, whether it's 10 flights or 20 flights or what have you. Yeah, I think it always falls back to the basics, and I think that's really important. And my experience, I'm sure your experience has been the same, and when we talk to other firefighters like the Vincent Dunns of the world, they will frequently tell us that, you know, what we do on a daily basis with those basics is in large part a reflection of how we're going to operate when it's the real deal.
You know, one thing about being part of your classes is, you know, when you come to our department and teach high-rise, the actual hands-on evolution is the second day. And you're out front teaching it. You're in your gear, you're hiking stairs, you're instructing, you know, from the front. How important is that, you know, to lead by example when you're teaching?
Well, I think that, you and I have heard it before, but with rank and file firefighters, I think that most of them, certainly the ones that are engaged and passionate about the profession, you know, I think that they're interested in what kind of street cred or street credibility somebody has. And, you know, for me, our expectation in my organization, the expectation I know in your organization in terms of firefighters being physically fit, especially for a high-rise operation, it's a high expectation. And I think regardless of who we are, how long we've been on the job, from time to time you have to give yourself a reality check and say, listen, this that I'm asking of them, is this something that I still have the ability to do? So part of that, you know, doing the lecture on day one and then doing the hands on day two and climbing up the stairs with the recruits, I think it's critically important, because once again, we need to make sure that we still have the ability physically and otherwise to do everything that we're asking of the recruits and the firefighters that are in our command. And that gives us an opportunity to do that. And yeah, the lead by example is certainly, that's alive and well, and that's always been very important to me, is to be able to lead by example. So when we do that class and we get in the stairwell and we start climbing up, toward the end of the day, you can be pretty beat up. I think it's important. I think the recruits appreciate that. I think that they know how important it is to you to make sure when they see that you can do it, to make sure that they can do it, that sort of thing. So, yeah, the leading by example is critical. There was the Commandant of the Marine Corps did a keynote many years back, and I remember hearing him say when he came on the stage, he introduced himself, and he said, I'm a United States Marine. And then he said, I'm also currently assigned as the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And his message was that every Marine's got to be a rifleman first. And I think that's important for us, too, in the fire service, that every firefighter, regardless of rank, from chief executive officer on down through battalion chiefs all the way down to a brand new probationary firefighter, we all need to be firefighters first. And I think it's important for us to be physically fit, to be able to still use that mask, to be able to still do the basic fundamental evolutions. Because the firefighters on the street, I think they're going to have more confidence in us if they know that, yes, we've been there and done that, but yes, we can still do it today. And so leading by example and physical fitness, I know those are hallmarks for you, and they certainly are for me as well.
High-rise is a high-risk but low-frequency event, and it's something that you are incredibly passionate about. How do you maintain your discipline for an event that might never happen as opposed to your bread and butter that you know you're going to?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, I think that a lot of it has to do with the passion and the engagement for the job and that sort of thing. Most of my career, I worked in high-rise areas. And so obviously, because of the number of high-rise buildings in the areas I worked, I felt that it was really critically important to stay engaged and, you know, specifically engaged in the high-rise operations and the high-rise portion of our game, if you will. I think part of that engagement can, once again, going back to the automatic alarms. You know, if a department is sending appropriate resources to an automatic alarm, and my philosophy is it should be at least an engine company, a truck company, and a chief officer. And that chief officer really needs to be responding to those as well. But staying engaged in those buildings and aware of what's going on in those buildings and familiar with those buildings. The low-frequency occurrence of the high-rise fire, when it does occur, you don't want to be that chief officer that's looking to the captain saying, hey, where's the command center at in this building? I haven't been here for a year. As opposed to, yeah, we went to all of those system malfunctions that's in this building, all of the automatic alarms that didn't turn out to be a full-blown fire, and we learned something each time we were there. So tonight we actually have something going on in this building, and we're going to be able to act appropriately and understand that building and do what we have to do. We all are human beings. We can all suffer from complacency to a greater or lesser extent. You try and surround yourself with people like you, Tom, so that if I'm having one of those days, you can look at me and say, hey, you know, step it up a little bit. If you happen to be having one of those days, I can say, hey, Tom, step it up a little bit. So we could kind of be the check and balance for one another. If we happen to be having one of those days, oh, we're going to that building again. Well, yeah, we're going to that building again, but this could be the real deal. This could be that low frequency event today. So it's a continuous battle. It's a battle that we have to fight throughout our career to fight human complacency and to have a mindset that says, yes, I understand this has a low probability of being a fire at this alarm that we're getting in this building again. Some of my more significant high-rise fires in my career started out as automatic alarms. The fire that I referenced earlier in the Polo Club condominiums in Southeast Denver, that came in as an automatic alarm. Engine, truck, and chief responded. No second source calls. No 911 calls. Turned out to be a third alarm fire. And one of the more significant events of my career. So I will hear guys from time to time will say, you know, if it's something real, we're going to get calls on it. Everybody has a cell phone. Well, sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's not, especially in the middle of the night. We might just get one call. It might just be an automatic alarm. And then when we get there, it's the real deal. And hopefully we're bringing our A game. And I think it's that passion and just the experience and surrounding yourself with a lot of really good people that are engaged and passionate about the job and not wanting to let them down. The other thing that I would add to that is, you know, I think most firefighters, I get this from you, certainly a lot of the people that you and I associate with, I think most firefighters, when they go to work, certainly none of us want anything bad to happen to anybody. We're not wishing for fires, we're not wishing for accidents or incidents or whatever, but I think most of the people that I associate with, if something's going to happen, they want it to happen on their shift. A fire, a significant event, a significant emergency, that sort of thing, because they've been preparing to deal with that for quite some time, and they want to be able to, you know, exercise their skills, if you will, and gain the experience of going to that incident. Obviously, most of our shifts, most of my shifts over the course of 35 years have ended without a significant incident for the day. You know, when I would go home from a work shift, I always had a great deal of pride and satisfaction knowing that everything we did during that shift was based on the basics and based on the fundamentals. We used good elevator discipline. We did proper apparatus placement. We laid supply lines as necessary. We stretched precautionary attack lines, even if water didn't come out of the nozzle. And we did all those things. And I had a great deal of satisfaction knowing that if something would have happened, if somebody had thrown a curveball at us, if there was one of those incidents that did turn out to be a working fire or a significant event of some sort, I believe we would have handled it appropriately because we were doing everything the way we were supposed to be doing it. So I was always satisfied at the end of a work shift that was not what you and I would consider an exciting work shift because of the fact that, yeah, we were doing everything with passion and with engagement and following the basics and trying to lead by example. And
you were staying disciplined every day.
Absolutely.
So in your class, you spend a bit of time talking about bringing your A game every day and how important that is. Would you mind sharing that story? And would you mind talking about that?
You know, it's one of those things for all of us as firefighters, we, over the course of time, both you and I and firefighters that have been on this job for any period of time, we've been to hundreds of incidents, perhaps thousands of incidents, various calls, fires, what have you. And the fact for all of us is many of the incidents that we respond to turn out to be something less than an emergency. But we don't know that when we get the call, and we have to treat it appropriately from the beginning and as you and I say, bring our A game to that incident. The call that, you know, as Chief Brunicini says, the call that Mrs. Smith calls us to her house for whatever it is, that's one of hundreds or thousands of calls that we've been on that we'll go to, but that's her one and only call. And that's the time when she's asking us to be our very best and give her the very best service we possibly can. So I think we always have to remain aware of that fact that this could be the 10th, the 15th, the 20th call for you of this work shift. This could be the 5th or 10th time you've been on a system malfunction today. This could be the 5th or the 10th time that you've been on an EMS call today that really didn't turn out to be a critical medical emergency. But whatever person that we're providing that service to, that's the most important call of their day, their week, their month. It might be the only time they ever have, you know, some sort of an engagement with the fire department, with emergency services. So it's a difficult thing for us to do, but I believe that we have to bring that A game every time so that we can provide the service that's appropriate to that individual. That's their call. It might be one of many for us, but that's their call. And you're referencing it from my personal life, you know, what happened with my son Joseph 14 years ago. My son Joseph just turned 14 years old here this past February 28th. And he's just a tremendous young man that my wife and I just love more than anything in the world. You know, 14 years ago, in February 28th, my wife and I went to a hospital in Metro Denver, and my wife, Gina, was carrying a baby. It was a full-term pregnancy. There were no problems. There were no complications. My wife is a woman that doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, is very healthy, works out, so on and so forth. So we had expectations of coming home from the hospital with a healthy child. And we had a 2-year-old daughter at the time who was healthy. And just like any other new parents, the hope and what you pray for and the expectation is that mom and baby will be healthy and that sort of thing. So during the process of the labor and the childbirth of our son Joseph, unbeknownst to us, the professionals that we had placed our trust in, they had certainly delivered countless babies before. And we were just one of many babies that they delivered and processes that they'd been through. The emergency call for them was the childbirth that they'd performed and that they would perform in the future. That childbirth that day was the most important one for my family, for my wife, and for our son Joseph. And unfortunately, in the process of that childbirth, the doctor and the nurse drifted into complacency. Simple as that, human complacency. I don't believe it was something they intended to do. I don't think there was any malicious intent or what have you. I think they were human beings and they drifted into complacency. And in the process of that complacency, there was a 17-minute period where what they thought they were seeing in terms of heart tones and what they thought they were seeing and hearing in terms of fetal heart tones were actually mom's heart tones. And in that 17-minute period, my son was suffocating. And he was suffocating because the cord was wrapped around his neck. It was cutting off circulation. It was cutting off blood supply, all those sorts of things. And unfortunately, they didn't recognize it. There was a nurse in the main outside area because we were in an individual birthing room, you know, several pods that you typically have at a hospital. And the nurse that was out in the main area came in to that room. And at the time, I didn't understand what was happening. And I understand it today, of course. But she came in and very urgently said, "You need to put mom on a pulse ox right now." And I didn't understand what that meant at the time. But they put my wife on a pulse ox. And that's when the doctor and the nurse in the birthing room realized that my son had drifted into asystole. And the tones that they were seeing and hearing were not field heart tones. They were mom's heart tones. And they had lost my son. So they went into overdrive, and Joseph was delivered. And when he was delivered, he was as dark blue as any cyanotic person that you and I have ever seen. And I always compare it to as dark blue as a Class B uniform shirt. But he was, he was gone. And the doctor still didn't have a sense of urgency, and the nurse still didn't have a sense of urgency. And as you know, as a father and a husband of a woman who's given birth, you don't want to leave your wife's side after she's just been through this significant, it's more than labor. It's something that we as men haven't experienced, but you don't want to leave your wife's side because she's done it, just been through this very difficult process. But I'm looking at my son over on this table, and he's not breathing, and he's not making any noise, and his color's not improving at all. And I said to the doctor, "He's not breathing." And the doctor said, "Oh, he'll start breathing." And it became more and more urgent. And before long, I found myself actually doing CPR and chest compressions and artificial respiration for my son in the process of these folks that we'd placed our trust in, trying to get their act together to get a team in there to take care of this child and intubate the child, so on and so forth. So it was a real difficult experience for my wife, for myself, and obviously for Joseph. In the process of that 17 minutes, he suffered a tremendous hypoxia, which severely damaged his brain. And he ended up in the neonatal intensive care. He was there for about 3 months. And there was one night when my wife and I and my mom, who's a retired nurse, we met with a neurosurgeon, and he put the CAT scans up on the board so we could look at it, and showed us the damage that was done and see extensive areas of damage, brain damage to Joseph's brain, and told us that the diagnosis would be cerebral palsy, and that it would be on the extremely severe side. And today, Joseph is nonverbal. The term that's used is called spastic quadriplegia because he doesn't have control over his limbs. Although he wants to control them, the message just doesn't work in his brain because of the cerebral palsy. We feed him with a gastric feeding tube, and he basically requires 100% care 100% of the time. And he's a wonderful little person. My dad refers to him as a saint among us, walking on earth, is what he is. But it has been a difficult but yet rewarding experience in many aspects. But one of the learning lessons for me was that we had placed our trust in these professionals. And these were experienced professionals with a significant pedigree, Harvard graduate, was some of the information about the doctor's experience and so forth. We'd placed our trust that they were going to bring their A game on the day that it was most important to us. And the bottom line is they didn't bring their A game that day. And had they brought their A game, they would have recognized this problem, I believe, before damage was done. And, whether it's an emergency C-section or whatever needed to be done could have been done that would have kept this young man from suffering severe brain damage. So that's our personal experience, and what has kind of reinforced for me and perhaps reignited or helped kindle the passion that you and I have about our profession, and that is that, you know, it might be your, like I say, 100th call, 1,000th call, 5,000th call in your career, or the 20th one for the work shift, but the person that you're providing service for, that's the most important call for them of the day. And whether it is just a basic EMS call or the automatic alarm in a building where it could be a fire or a bona fide working fire with multiple calls, we need to be bringing our A game every time because that's what they're paying us for. And it's a difficult thing and it's exhausting because you're exhausted at the end of the shift by being engaged and so forth for every single call. But I think that's what they pay us for.
Yeah, I think it's important to know, like, you're not sharing this story, you know, for anything else other than hoping people know how important their job is on a daily basis and to eliminate complacency.
Absolutely. And, you know, and we talk about complacency a lot. And when I talk to the recruits, whether it's your recruits or wherever they happen to be, firefighters from wherever, I can speak to complacency both from a professional side as a firefighter, and I can speak to it also from a personal side as being on the receiving end of complacency. And once again, we're all human beings. And the medical staff involved in my son's situation, you know, they were human beings. They had drifted into human complacency that day. And we have to make sure that we don't drift into complete human complacency. And when we start down that path, we got to fight it, and we have to surround ourselves with good people that can push us out of it, you know, give us a kick in the butt if we need it. Say, hey, wait a minute, this could be the real deal here. So
what qualities are you looking for in firefighters that are on your scene or in your firehouse?
That's a great question, Tom. There's so many things that make that, I guess, for lack of a better word, that ideal firefighter. And none of us as firefighters are perfect, for sure. But the firefighters that I look to and really respect and really admire are certainly those firefighters that are passionate in our profession. They're engaged in the profession. They're physically and mentally prepared and have that really positive attitude. They're people you want to be around, just real positive. And I tell this story from time to time, but I had a couple of young firefighters. This happened many years ago, but a couple of young firefighters had asked to see me and talk about the assessment center process for a promotional exam. And they were firefighters that I would describe as nice guys. You can't help but to like them. They're nice guys, but not good firefighters, not top shelf firefighters, because of a lack of engagement and a lack of, you know, physical and mental preparedness and that sort of thing. But hoping that maybe they could turn the corner and become the type of firefighter we'd like to see, I certainly was very much willing to help them. And once again, they were in the process of trying to promote, and they came in and we talked about assessment centers. And at the end of our long conversation, both firefighters, with one of them speaking, kind of asking the same question, said, do you have any other advice for us? And you know, not meaning to be a jerk, not meaning to be negative, not meaning to be condescending, but I told them, I said, yeah, honestly, here's what I'd like you to consider is, try to be engaged in this job all the time, not just when there's a reading list that's just come out for a promotional exam, not just when there's a promotional process and you have a chance to get promoted and get a pay raise and that sort of thing. Stay engaged all the time, 100% of the time. That's what this job needs, is firefighters that are engaged all the time. And I'm not sure if it resonated with them. I'm not sure if it was something that they didn't want to hear, what have you, but I just wanted to speak the truth to them. And so I think more than anything else, Tom, is I'm looking at firefighters and the ones that I admire, the ones that I want to work with, the company officers that I want to have in my command, the chief officers that I want to work side by side with, the chief executive officers and the command staff that I want to work for are folks that are engaged in the fire department and the fire service, really, truly engaged in it. It's not just a part-time job for them. They're not a full-time real estate agent. Part-time firefighter is one of the examples we often use. But engaged and passionate and physically and mentally prepared for what's going to happen, and that positive person, because We've all been around a negative person in the firehouse where it doesn't matter what it is. I should have gotten that overtime shift, not that guy. You know, I deserve to have got that transfer, not that guy. You know, why are we going to this building again? This is probably just another false alarm. That negativity, one person that's really negative can bring down a whole crew, a whole company of firefighters. So the really positive, passionate, engaged, physically and mentally prepared firefighter, that's who I want to work with. And that's the kind of firefighter I want to be.